The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 902. It's the 20th of October, 2017. On the podcast today, I have Hanno Pengilly, Chief Development Officer of Nkondesi Energy, that's NCCL. And Hanno discusses the agreement with China Machinery Engineering Corporation and General Electric South Africa in regards to their coal-fired power project and open pit coal mine in Mozambique. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about Brexit, some significant news coming out from central banks in the next few weeks, and also covers the stocks Zytronic, that's ZYT, Marlow, MRL, and Hornby, HRN, blast from the past there. And also, as always, I have the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Hanno Pengilly, Chief Development Officer of Nkondesi Energy. That's NCCL ticker. Hanno, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me on again, Justin.
Now, as I'm looking, your share price is strongly up. It's been up 60%. It's run about 40% up, but the average daily volume after an hour of trading is 10 times your normal sort of average daily volume. So it's going well off the back of the news you've released today, and we'll get into that in a bit. But before we do, Hanno, can you explain for people not aware of the company or new to the podcast exactly what Nkondesi Energy is all about, please?
Sure, I'll give a quick summary. Nkondesi is a integrated mine and power plant company looking to develop a 300 megawatt coal-fired power plant in the Tet province of Mozambique.
Excellent stuff. And I suppose the last 6 to 12 months have been a bit of a rollercoaster ride for shareholders, haven't they? But like I said, they're probably thankful if they held on today because, like I said, a pretty sharp rise in the share price. And this is off the back of this agreement, a non-binding offer with GE and CMEC. So first of all, I suppose, Hannah, can we go back? So if, I don't know when it was. Was it in the summer maybe when you had a partner as a SEP and that sort of fell apart there? What happened? And then moving forward to this, if you could, please.
Sure. So, look, the last 4 or 5 months have been very eventful. I think it all kicked off with a previous Chinese partner, Shanghai Electric Power. The discussions that had been ongoing for a number of years being suspended by the company because progress was just not being made. We then implemented a very clear strategy and program to bring on a new partner because we believed in the project. It's a very advanced project. We believe the most advanced coal-fired project in the Southern African region. It's in an attractive part of Africa in Mozambique, which has a good track record of delivering projects, is a large energy generator in the region. And it had attractive economic fundamentals as well. So the decision was made. We needed to go out and run a new partner process, which ultimately culminated in today's announcement, where we are very excited to have what we believe to be world-leading partners in GE and CMEC. I must highlight the fact that they obviously have a strong global reputation in the power space, but what makes them truly unique is that they're both currently operating in Mozambique in the power space as well as in other sectors. And so we're dealing with two very experienced partners here, which have specific experience in the region, which will certainly assist us in delivering this project. And really, it follows a number of other milestones which have been achieved in the period. As investors will know, we had a $5 million shareholder loan that was due to mature at the beginning of September, which we were able to extend until September 2018. We also were only capitalized to run the process, the new partner process, until the end of September. And earlier this week, as people will have seen, we successfully raised £750,000. Fortunately, it was oversubscribed, so a big success for us. And really, it's put the project on a platform now where, you know, we are on the right path to de-risking and unlocking the project's potential over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I'm sure there's people, like I said, there was that area of uncertainty. And at one point, I think it was, I'm looking on the 26th of May, the share price at 1.15 pence. And now looking today, the share price is 9.25 as I'm looking right now. So I think people who jumped in there just did very well, you know, really trading into uncertainty there. But like you said, it now looks, you know, like it's going ahead. So as far as the next milestone is concerned, so I see there's a date. You're looking for, you know, a joint development. Cause at the moment, it's non-binding, isn't it? So you're looking to turn this into a joint development agreement by the 30th of April, 2018. And is that the maximum time? Like, I mean, can it be done before that or what?
Well, look, you know, just, you know, I think the important thing to highlight here is that, you know, well, two things. First of all, GE and CMEC have been part of a process that's been going on for 4 months now, you know, which has included detailed due diligence on the project, various discussions with Enkondesi. And now I think we're at a stage where we can go into, you know, the more advanced part of the due diligence and, most importantly, the binding documentation negotiations. But really, the main thing that this allows is for the discussions now with government to take place. You know, the Mozambican government is very supportive of us bringing on a new partner. They're very supportive of the partners that we brought on board. I think they're very, you know, they have a good reputation operating in Mozambique. But really, for those, you know, for those government discussions to take place with regards to getting support for the new partner, you know, we needed to get this non-binding offer behind us and into the public domain. And so, really, the proper discussions can now happen. Although, you know, I would highlight that we have been through a process. There is the outline of what the binding documentation will look like, so we all have a good idea of what we're working towards. Obviously, everyone's working towards trying to achieve this sooner. I'd like to highlight we've been through a process like this before. So, from an Enkondesi perspective, much of the work is complete. It's in order. It's just a case of, I guess, going through, you know, you know, a very detailed process here, which, or a planned process, which, you know, we have agreed with CMEC and GE over the coming months. And obviously both parties will push to try and get this as done as soon as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how it'll work is that it'll be what, they're looking to the integrated project, and the guys at CMEC and GE will acquire a minimum of 60% equity stake in that project. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And look, this is, you know, this is a very new space for a lot of people. I'm fully aware of that. You know, a big thing with these power projects is that, you know, these are very chunky projects. You're talking about $1 billion capex spend here to develop this thing. And, you know, Enkondesi is a developer. It's not an operator. And likewise with other small power development projects in the region, you know, these projects need to find the partner that has the expertise, the balance sheet to build and operate this thing. So, you know, a big hurdle for a lot of the development projects is identifying who that partner will be, who will bring that big equity check, who will bring that develop that construction and operational experience. And so with this deal, I think we're addressing one of the major project development milestones in identifying who that partner is. I would also want to highlight that this deal does differ from previous deal that Enkondesi had, specifically in that GE and CMEC are looking at the project as an integrated project, which means that they are not looking at taking a 60% stake in just the power plant. They're looking at the power plant and the mine as a single entity. And that further de-risks the project. It also simplifies the project in that, you know, you're now not talking about two different entities having to negotiate with each other. It's all seen as one integrated project. I would also highlight another important factor of this transaction is the fact that we're moving back to CFB boiler technology. This is important because the development work that was done by Enkondesi on the CFB technology is much more advanced than we ever were able to get to with the previous technology. And that creates significant time benefits, and that we don't have to rerun technical documentation. We can actually fast track the process, which we're very excited about.
Yeah, and you said that the last, you know, with SCP, it sort of broke down because it wasn't advancing. And And like I said, with, you did mention there's, of course, always risks with new partners. But do you feel now that, you know, with these partners right now, that they mean business and they're moving it forward?
Look, let's look at the time frames in which we've been able to get to where we are. I think, you know, we've moved faster in the last 4 months, you know, than we did in a significantly longer period with our previous partner. And I think that's a largely due to the fact that we're dealing with two entities that are much more experienced in the region and specifically experienced in Mozambique. They also have reputations in the country that they're very proud of, and I'm sure they're very keen to maintain. That's not to say that there aren't additional risks still going forward. There's still a lot of work to do, but you know, the important thing is we're adequately capitalized to do that work. And I think it's also, you know, it shouldn't be taken for granted that, you know, we had a project here where a partner walked away. You know, we had to suspend discussions with a partner because they couldn't deliver. And I think, you know, when you see something like that, you know, immediately what goes through your head is, you know, is there something potentially wrong with the project that we're not aware of? You know, what is going on behind closed doors? I think the fact that we've been able to turn this thing around in such a short time frame, you know, one is credit to the company and the team operating it in terms of delivering a clear and planned strategy. But two, it is also a reflection of the attractiveness of this project.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's good news. And I know someone's listening right now and likes the sound of this, but they're not yet following you on Vox Markets. Could you give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please?
Sure. The first one, I think, is fairly obvious with today's announcement, in that we've just brought on board two fantastic partners in GE and CMEC, who, you know, provide a massive potential to de-risk and unlock future project value. The second one is that over the next 6 months, we expect a number of milestones to be achieved leading up to the binding documentation. And the final one is that, you know, that amongst all of this, we mustn't forget the large economic potential of this project. These are billion-dollar projects, but, you know, and obviously there's lots of sensitivity with the numbers and negotiating tariffs, but they tend to generate somewhere between $2-3 billion of net cash flow disbursements to investors over their lifespan. So these are significant economic upsides over the term of the project.
Excellent. And Hannah, like you said, you've got plenty of news coming up. So hopefully we'll chat again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And now you're all knowledgeable over, you know, micro and macro. And so let's have a quick overview of macro. Do you know what struck me there? I just want to get on the, I'm scared to mention the B words. It does separate friends and families whenever people start discussing about it.
I mean, it does.
There's so many people on Facebook that unfriend each other because that vote is unbelievable. Anyway, but I thought it was quite a clever ploy. And it seems people saying Theresa May is begging, you know, Angela Merkel or whatever they are, or the powers that be out there, for her to come back to Britain with a deal she can put to the British people, you know, or some kind of thing. And I thought, first of all, I thought that's desperate. Then I thought, hang on a sec, that's quite clever, because it's almost that they know, Angela Merkel and whoever's elected there will know the kind of powers they come under or the pressures they come under from the electorate, you know. And I think if you put that to them, it's almost like saying, come on, you know what it's like. I've got to go back to them with a decent guy. And it may play well. I mean, obviously, people are hoping to knock her down a lot politically and say, oh, look, she's begging for a deal here. But part of me thought, yeah, it's quite a shrewd little
move. Well, I guess it might resonate with the Europeans, because they didn't give Cameron a big bone, did they, before the referendum?
Yeah.
I think partly because Cameron was A, indolent, and B, convinced that the referendum would go pre-EU anyway. But they didn't give him a big bone. And that backfired. So it may be a reminder to them to say, look, actually, we do need some help here. But I think in the end, we're still in poker playing territory. You know, Theresa May didn't get a massive mandate from the British people. She's not in the position to be, quote, that bloody difficult woman that was clearly her intention to be. And the narrative has slightly slipped away from her. Equally, the Europeans need the money. There is a UK-shaped hole in their budgets.
Yeah.
They're not exactly flush with cash anyway. So both sides need something. The Europeans don't want to make it look too easy for the British, because they don't want to encourage the Italians or anybody else. You've got that Italian referendum election coming up next year, in theory, unless they fudge the rules again and go for another technocracy. But, you know, Matteo Renzi the Partito Democratico, the PD, does lead in the polls right now, but the opposition parties, Salvini's Northern Front, Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia, and Beppe Grillo's Five Star Movement, they're all anti-EU parties. Between them, they get a much bigger percentage of the vote than the pro-EU PD does. Now, the chances of those three parties working with each other is probably pretty limited, but nevertheless, you might not get a big pro-EU mandate from Italy either. So, the Europeans will want to draw a line and say, we're not going to make this easy for anybody. Remember, it took them 4 years to agree with Greenland on fishing rights when Greenland, you know, sort of seceded from EU law. Yeah. So it isn't going to be easy. But in the end, Britain needs a deal and doesn't want to hand over loads of lolly, but still wants to keep access to trade. Europe does need the lolly, wants to deter anybody else. So, and I think the history of the EU shows, looking through the Greek crisis all the way back to 2010, 11, 12, there will be a fudge, a compromise, whatever you want to call it, but it will come at the last minute when there is absolutely no alternative. And I think that's probably the way the negotiations are going to go.
Yeah, that's it. It's got to be a deal done. And like you say, it will happen. I mean, that's what the last minute was invented for, is this kind of, you know, and until there's that hard barrier there, they will just mess around with it until they have to do it. They will mess around, you know?
And, correct.
Anything else happening around the world of macro then, Russ?
Well, I guess in the end, I actually like talking less about central banks than I do like talking about Brexit, which, you know, because in the end, for me, stock, you know, financial markets, it's all about stocks. It's all about company dynamics. Mm-hmm. But what you've clearly had over the last 8, 9, 10 years, are central banks appointing themselves as kind of masters of markets in that, you know, they've all said, look, we want to get financial asset valuations up because we want to create a wealth effect and we think that will trickle down to the broader economy. Now, whether you think that's working or not, mm-hmm. I will leave to people. Personally, I think it's clearly created asset price inflation. Just look at the charts. Take you 2 seconds to work it out. Mm-hmm. Has it created a wealth effect? For the wealthy? Yes. For the people who own the assets? Yes. I think you can argue that for obviously those people who don't own the assets because they don't have the disposable in the income, in the disposable income in the first place? Probably not. And that's why you do, I think, get greater discussion of social inequality and the 1% and the 99%. I think there are laws of unintended consequences here. Yeah. But central banks have, through QE and they've crushed interest rates, they've crushed bond yields, they've forced money into equities, they've forced people to take more risk than perhaps they would normally do to get a decent return on their cash, and they've done that by design. Mm-hmm. So now we're clearly entering a very interesting period whereby the European Central Bank on the 26th may announce that it's going to start to slightly dial down its QE program, or run it beyond the December deadline, but at a lower level, but keep running it. Will the Federal Reserve, you know, drop heavy hints of a fifth interest rate increase this cycle on the 1st of November? Probably go through with the December meeting. There's a 75% chance going to futures markets. Will the Bank of England end this policy hokey-cokey and actually commit, you know, do an interest rate increase on the 2nd? And in the same week, you've got the Bank of Japan, which I think, frankly, will just sit back and just stay on QE full tilt and see how the others get on. But I think we are entering a very interesting period now. I've actually sat and done the maths between them. They're throwing in the Swiss National Bank as well, which, by the way, now is one of the biggest shares in the world in Apple, interestingly, because of its QE program. Oh. Throw in the Swiss, throw in the Brits, the Japanese, the Europeans, and the Americans, and central banks have injected about $11.5 trillion into the global economy through QE since 2008. That's about 15% of global GDP. And if you believe that it has, and you can draw a line, by the way, aggregating those central bank balance sheets against the FTSE All World Index, and it's pretty good. So clearly then you've got a big question mark of what happens if they start to withdraw.
Yeah,
and they start to take liquidity.
Yeah.
And I think now, and that's a big issue. And okay, if you get a world economy that is starting to accelerate, and mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily feel like it, but if you look at the OECD statistics, the world's 40 biggest economies are all growing this year and forecast to grow next year. Yeah. And that's the first time that's happened in ages. And I've come clean now. I didn't come up with that statistic myself. A fund manager gave it to me yesterday. So thank you, M&G.
So say that again.
World's 40 biggest economies.
Yeah, 40, wow.
According to the OECD, are all growing GDP this year and next year. Mm. And that's the first time that's happened probably for a decade, I would guess. Mm-hmm. And that's courtesy of M&G and a fund manager I met there yesterday. So you are, in theory, getting a bit of a synchronized global economic recovery, which maybe is why the central banks feel they can tamp back on the on the stimulus. But equally, it may mean that corporate earnings are strong enough to withstand any tightening. So, but that's the key question. We know valuations are high. We know that in the US and the UK, corporate profits are at a record high. They're not in Europe, by the way, and I don't think they are in Asia. I'm not far off. Valuations in the US are at record highs. The UK, their middles are high. Europe, their middles are high. Asia and emerging markets, actually, related to their history, are not expensive at all.
Yeah.
So the key challenge is, if the central banks start to step back, when their influence has clearly been very positive in terms of asset valuations, surely you would expect there to be some negative impact if they start to withdraw. And if you look at history, it's taken about 8 rate rises to slow the US market down. And this will be the 5th if they do it in December. And if they deliver on 3 more next year, as they're currently talking, then that will take you to 8. So let's see. So it is going to be a very, very key time for markets after a very long run. I know there's been lots of talk this week of the 87 crash anniversary. You know, you look at any market upswing, many market downswing, 2 things dominate all: liquidity and leverage. There's loads of liquidity around right now, so that means that the loads of leverage we've got right now isn't a problem because it's affordable. But what happens if liquidity dries up and the leverage then has to be unwound? That's when you've got classic recipe for a serious market retrenchment.
And when what date will that happen, Russ? Tell me.
No idea, mate.
Yeah, I was going to say, I need a day.
But some of the classic signs that you watch out for aren't happening. Okay. What you would expect to see at this stage of the cycle is rampant initial public offering activity. You know, something has got to suck that liquidity away. And in 1999-2000, it was rampant IPO activity, and it was, bless him, Gordon Brown auctioning off 3G spectrum for about 23 billion quid. All the other European governments thought, wahey, money for jam, brilliant, Gordon, well done. They did the same. There was a rampant M&A in telecoms at the same time, and all the money just disappeared on a massive 3G spectrum plug hole. In 2005-07, it was rampant IPO activity, diggers and drillers particularly, but generally anything that investment bankers could lay their hands on. Mm-hmm. And of course, all this money was flooding into property, into these extremely complex derivative products, collateralized debt obligations and everything else, which when they went wrong, again, just destroyed that liquidity. So that's what you're looking for. So where's the liquidity going now? Well, you're not seeing huge amounts of IPOs. In fact, companies are paying out record dividends and record levels of buybacks. So money's coming the other way at the same time as the central banks are shoveling it on. So the world is awash with liquidity. If liquidity is going anywhere, it's going into tracker funds and ETFs. And so that's why you're seeing lots of articles in the pink paper right now about ETFs. I think they're inherently a useful tool, but that's all they are, a tool. They've got to be treated with respect like any other tool, so you don't chop your finger off when you're using it. And I think that there is a danger that people are using ETFs as liquid punting instruments, not as investment tools. And there is therefore a danger that when everybody's piling in when things go well, what happens if people start to pile out when things go badly? And that is something that I think we do need to therefore perhaps watch more closely, is ETF flows, particularly if IPO flows remain pretty muted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get on to individual stocks. Wow.
Exactly. So three for the field. I mean, they're all ones that we've talked about before. Zitronic, Marlowe and Hornby are the three that we'll talk about this week.
Yeah, Zitronic, I remember them from a long time ago when I decided not to invest unwisely. But
we talked about it back in February, March, when the thing was at 4 quid and it's actually gone above 6 quid. It's just pulling back a little bit now. Yeah. Remember, it manufactures rugged touch interactive displays and screens, outdoor use at cash machines, but increasingly indoor use, gaming, vending, things like that. In fact, the screens it makes anything from 5 to 85 inches. The bigger the screen, the more curved it is, the higher margin the business because it's more complex, surprise, surprise. 3 factories up near Newcastle upon Tyne. And, you know, I think all we just need to quickly touch on this week is there was a trading statement earlier in the week from Bossmark Cambridge who just said, full year results to September, everything's in line. Thank you very much. Literally, full stop. And you've just seen the share price come off on the back of that. And I think that's purely because the shares have had a fabulous run if you look at the chart. Yeah. And you know, when we talked about them back in March, they were about 13 times earnings with a yield of 4% plus. They're now on 20 times earnings with a yield of 2.5. So the valuation is, you know, it's looking full. And, you know, once you've got a valuation up at those levels, inline's not going to cut it in the short term. It's going to have to be a beat. So anybody who's, you know, who's got 40, 50% profits from the spring is going to think, actually, let's bank some of those and come back when the company reports its full numbers. I'll just give it a bit of breathing space. And I think that's probably what you'll see. So fabulous company, great competitive position, net cash balance sheet, sensible management. But at the moment, I think a lot of it's probably in the shop window in the short term.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when they've gone from £4 to like what £6 odd, since March, and yeah, they, like you said, they don't give an update that says, "Wow, strap in, we're going to have amazing." If they don't say that, then they're going to pull back a bit, aren't they? So
they are, and I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. All right. So next one is Marlowe, is it?
Marlowe. Yes. Remember, this is we looked at this in the spring. It's the company that provides fire detection, air quality detection, and water detection system, sprinklers, which, as we know, is a politically enormous issue after what happened at that building in Kensington in the summer. And Marlowe is therefore a company that is potentially able to deal with the increased regulation that I'm sure will follow in the wake of the Grenfell disaster. And this is a young company, only floated in spring 2016. It's got a market cap on AIM about 120 odd million quid. And again, it's just one of these, its first half results are in December, but it's just produced a trading statement. And again, the magic words were in line, full stop. But the statement was a little bit longer than the Zitronic one, because they've been making acquisitions. They've made 4 acquisitions in the period. They're looking for more. And so I think strategically the company's in a great place. It's clearly got interesting products. Mm-hmm. Equally, it is obviously therefore a bit of a roll-up. And, you know, roll-ups, when you're buying up lots of small competitors in a fragmented market, can work brilliantly, you know, who've got a great track record of making integration. Alma, for example, which isn't a roll-up in any sense. That's just bolt-ons. But equally, roll-ups, if you don't do it, you know, RPC Group has been a roll-up that's worked incredibly well so far. But what you must make sure is that they maximise value from them. There's no cost overlap. They're all integrated, and they don't pile up loads of debt doing it. Marlowe's got plenty of cash at the moment, so that's fine. It's a stock on a high multiple, mid-20s. Mm-hmm. So again, they've got to make sure that the acquisitions are nailed down very, very quickly. The share price chart, to be fair, doesn't look that clever. It's sort of gently dribbling down. And I think that's just because people are waiting to make sure that they can digest these acquisitions. So I think great products, great strategic position. They now need to prove that they can make these acquisitions work. And I think if you're patient, you're prepared to tough it out. All well and good, it should pan out fine. But you do need to make sure that they can get these things to all stick together and work together.
Do you know what I was surprised at hearing? Theresa May on Prime Minister Question Time earlier in the week asked about sprinklers, and they're not automatically now fitting sprinklers into tower blocks. And I know, and someone just said, first of all, it's up to the councils, but then she said there are a number of aspects that have to be looked at in relation to safety in tower blocks. It is not the case that sprinklers are the only issue that needs to be looked and addressed, nor is it the only solution to ensuring their safety.
No, I'm sure that's right.
I hope it's not skimping on that, but I mean, I hope that is the case. But
I would think you'd put them in as a basic anyway, and then make sure there are things like 2 staircases to get down rather than 1, for example. So,
I was surprised to hear that, though. I suppose they've had advice by experts, and they said that's not the only answer, but I was surprised
to hear
that.
I don't doubt it. Yeah, I was as well. So, anyway.
And the last one, Russ, is Hornby.
Yes, which, again, we've talked about a lot, and it's one that I've really not liked. And to be fair, the shares haven't worked out that well. Iconic brands, mm-hmm. Scale Extric, Airfix, mm-hmm. Hornby, you know, great names, especially from when we were kids. But the Kent-based firm, it's continuing to have an extremely difficult time. Mm. You know, it gave out a profit warning in September, and it's actually just doled out another one this week. The new boss has come in, Lyndon Davis, had a look at it and gone, okay. And the reason that he's gone this week is that he said he's changing the company's policy, so it's not going to offer bulk discounts on large shipments, I guess to try and preserve the value of the company's brands and try and give them some pricing power. You know, if you look at the company last year, it ended the year with 10 million, just under 10 million quid of inventory, 9.7 million. Put that against 23.9 million cost of goods sold. So 9.7 divided by 29.3, then you multiply that by 365, and that's how you get the number of days inventory the company has, and it's got 120 days. So its stock isn't really turning that quickly, which, all right, for its brands probably isn't the end of the world. If you were a refashion retailer, you'd be, you know, your knickers would be knotted because you've got far too much stock knocking about. I mean, this stuff doesn't date, but equally rapid stock turn can mean good margin, can mean good cash flow. So he's clearly having to, you know, manage the inventory as best he can, but he clearly doesn't want to give it away either. So he's now said revenues are going to disappoint. Profits will therefore be, quote, materially below expectations. And this is just the latest in a string of profit warnings from Hornby. I mean, it's made losses for the last 5 years. As a result, the interim chairman, David Adams, decided he'd rather go and do something else instead, or the new CEO coming in. Maybe they've just thought they've got different philosophies there. So Hornby's a really tricky one because it's got good brands. You know, it's, you can see where there's potential there. There's a new CEO coming in, and the, you can now split this either way. Phoenix Asset Management actually own about 55% of the stock, but they have, although they've bought it, they haven't taken it private. It's still on the stock market. There are still some institutional shareholders. Now, you might think, perfect. You've got a fund manager in charge here who clearly passionately believe in it, and they will give it as long as it takes to turn it around. Yeah. So we can be patient now, because the share price didn't really flinch that much. Equally, you can take the view as a shareholder, look, I've got no voice here, because these guys own a big majority stake. Even if I scream till I'm blue in the face that they're doing something wrong, they're going to politely ignore me because they're in there because they think they can do it better. So you pay your money, you take your choice. For me, in the end, you have a company that's lost money for 5 years in a row. The sales have gone from 57 to 47 million quid. And as we've discussed before, do the Xbox generation, in the end, really care that much or want to sit down that much gluing an Airfix kit together or playing with Scalex tricks or Hornby trains? Not sure.
Yeah.
I think the structural challenge there, the demographic generational challenge, is potentially too big for Hornby to overcome in the long run.
Yeah, I hope I'm wrong. Well, I don't think it's a growing sector, is it? Let's be honest. I mean,
yeah. Toys at, are.
Yeah. I mean, do you know what? My children still love, I mean, they're 4 and 7, do love board games. They still love board games.
Yeah, I always do. Monopoly, until they start arguing over it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And but I'm looking at the chart there on Hornby, and it looks like one of those heart rate monitors, you know, with doot,
yeah,
doot, just going on a straight line with doot, a little up and down, and then you're just thinking, is that going to stop? Dude, because
I think that's the impact of the dominant shareholder, which again, you can view as a good thing, they're going to give them time, or a bad thing, why is anybody going to bother playing when they're in charge?
Yeah.
I just think, you know, there are 2,000 companies in the UK quoted. There are lots of others. You clearly, as a child, are going to have more of a say on, and probably taking less risk.
Yeah, that's all. To us, always a good thought. That's a good thought to end on. I mean, you often see people, you know, having fear of missing out on investments. Yeah. I see that in this junior markets, people jumping into a stock when it's rallied strongly, and you got to realise, especially on AIM, you know, there's almost 1,000 companies there. You know, if you're looking for a growth company with high risk, there's plenty. You know, don't go chasing a story. There's plenty to look at. There's loads there. There's plenty of stories there that could have potential. Don't have fear of missing out. There's no point. Russ, thanks for that. Have a nice
day. It's a pleasure. And you, speak to you soon.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, UK Oil and Gas, you cog. At 4, Jersey Oil and Gas, Jog. At 3, I spoke to Hanno earlier on, it's Ncontesi Energy, NCCL. At 2, it's been there for a few days now, Vast Resources, VAST. And at number 1, it's been there, I think, last 4 days, I think, Greatland Gold, GGP, was followed company in the last 24 hours, and the last 4 or 5 days, I think. Okay, top 5 most liked RNSs are as follows. At 5, Zenith Energy, ZEN, a Zabdab field operation update. At 4, Strategic Minerals, SML, result of general meeting. At 2, Hanno, on the podcast earlier, Ncontesi Energy, NCCL, agrees non-binding offer with GE and GMEC. At 2, Rhea Bold Resources, RBD, board appointments and issue of options. That was late yesterday afternoon. And number 1, most liked RNS on the platform in the last 24 hours, came from Ascent Resources, AST, operational update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to ft.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT Subscription.